The following is Steven Anderson's talk, What's Your Perception Strategy? Why It's Not All About Content, from the 2012 Information Architecture Summit. The 2012 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by User Interface Engineering and the UIE Virtual Seminar Program. Stay tuned after the podcast for a special offer from UIE.
Okay, it's 1:45. We'll go ahead and get started on time. Just a quick introduction, so there's context for everything I'm about to talk about. My name is Steven P. Anderson, and I help companies with product strategy and design needs. And most recently, or for the past 9 months, that's tended to be startups in the educational technology space. I've been working with a couple of really wonderful startups out in Palo Alto doing some great things in education. My interest, starting about 3 or 4 years ago, started veering into psychology and what we can learn about the human brain and human behavior to the extent that it can influence what I do every day as an interaction designer. As kind of a learning project and a way to make sense of all these things I was reading about, I created a deck of cards called the Mental Notes Card Deck. You'll see little cards fly up throughout this presentation. All you need to know is those are single ideas from psychology. So if you see those pop in, that's what those are. That's a card deck I created about 2 years ago. And then that led to a book that I wrote earlier this summer, or was published earlier this summer, called Seductive Interaction Design. It's really about that initial encounter, that initial engagement on a website or web app, and how we actually get people to stick around long enough to see the value that we have in our services. So with that said, I will talk a lot about psychology. I'll talk a lot about cognition, neuroscience. I find these topics fascinating, but this is not anything I was formally trained in. At the end of the day, I'm a designer. That's who I am, what I love. But in order to become a better designer, I recognize that I needed to learn more about these things that really are about human behavior. So that's my disclaimer. So if your background is in cognitive neuroscience or something like that, and I get some details wrong, you can slap me afterwards. In fact, I invite you to. All right, so given what I'm going to be talking about today and that it could be kind of controversial, I thought we'd start with something that's not controversial that we can all agree on, and that's chocolate. All right, raise your hand if you like chocolate. All right, good, most of you. Before I came here, I was asking a few friends, some foodie friends, I was telling them about what I was going to do, and I was asking them, can you recommend some local artisan chocolate places in New Orleans, you know, particularly some that have a local flavor? And one of my friends wrote me back, and he recommended two places, and one of them that really stood out was this, and he said, the first chocolatier that comes to mind is Sucre. The owner, Chef Tariq Hanna, is considered one of the top chocolate and pastry chefs in the USA and is known for his unique chocolates. I was like, that's it, that's the one I want. And so I went there earlier this week and bought some chocolates for the workshop I did, went back yesterday and bought some that I'm gonna hand out in a few minutes for a lucky 32 of you, because this chocolate's it's quite expensive, okay? But they're local, they make the chocolate here. They used to make it in their shop, but now they have a separate facility where they make it. But it's all made daily, it's made fresh, good ingredients, and they have a local flavor as well. A lot of their things they make try to incorporate salts from the Avery salt mines, for example, or some of the local New Orleans flavors. There's some pictures of the shop and the chef right there. And they're not just chocolates, they're known kind of for their macaroons as well. In fact, small world, a good friend of mine back in Dallas who has really good taste in food, he said, oh yeah, I just ordered some macaroons from them. And I was like, okay. So I went there, great place. Of course, I did what any obsessive person would do before I went there. I searched on the internet to see what was said about them. And this place, Sucre, was named one of the country's top 10 pastry chefs, or actually the chef was, by Dessert Professionals magazine. Yelp, you know, gave it 4 stars, 200 plus reviews. This is a headline that really sealed the deal for me. Tariq Hanna, the new Willy Wonka. And then he's won a couple times on some of those TLC cooking shows. He's won there. So that's a little bit about the place and the head chocolatier there. The two chocolates I selected, the first one is called the Avery, and this is their most popular chocolate. In fact, if you go to their website, there's a video showing how they make it and everything. It's a caramel milk chocolate ganache coated in dark chocolate and topped with a touch of sea salt. And it's named the Avery because the sea salt that's mixed in and topped actually comes from the Avery Islands nearby. The other one, the person who I was asking for recommendations, she said this was her favorite. So the Avery is the most popular. The Meunier is her favorite. And I tried it, and wow, it was one of those that's really remarkable and stood out. And it's brown butter folded into a white chocolate ganache, coated in a dark chocolate. It's really phenomenal. I wish I could buy one for everyone, but again, this was probably $80 of chocolate in this little box here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start it on the front row, and if you guys just pass down, those of you who are brave enough to sit in the front will actually get some of this. I think there's 16 of each. Now, I realize if you're sitting in the second or third row back, you're like, ah, this sucks, right? It's not quite the same, but I did, you know, stop at the Walgreens around the corner. And I got some Doves and I got some Hershey's Kisses, so you guys can go ahead and, you know, grab, experiment, see if you can tell the difference, yep. I think you can, by the way. So you guys can just open those and pass them around. All right. So as you're tasting these, as you can see, it's not really about the chocolate. In fact, by the time you eat this, it's going to taste phenomenal, those of you on the front row who can enjoy this. And there's lots of reasons why. There's the story, obviously, and everything that wrapped around it. There's the packaging. Did you guys see that? The packaging that came in. There are things like the fact that I hinted at the price. We have this idea called value attribution, where if something's priced higher, we tend to assume it's going to be better. The fact that I introduced the inferior chocolates actually makes this chocolate taste better, right? Behavioral economics has proven this time and time again. So there's all these other things besides that bite of chocolate itself that are going to influence your perceptions of the chocolate. In fact, if we step back and take a very light look at what's going on, you have all those things, your experience of the chocolate. So those of you who are enjoying this, there's all these things that are going to contribute to your experience of the chocolate, but that is very different from the reality of the chocolate that's out there. And so that's kind of the first principle I wanted to mention, is that your brain constructs an experience of reality. And so there's the reality, the objective truth out there, and then there's your simulation of it. So every time you experience something, it's a simulation of whatever is out there. And philosophers and neuroscientists have debated what is out there and the nature of reality. I'm not going to go there. But that's kind of the basic idea. And we know, or we create these simulations based on things that come through our senses. And I'll come back to this in just a minute. But the other point I want to point out, and this is kind of fundamental to everything that I'm going to be talking about, is that perception is not a process of active absorption. Like, we usually think of perceiving stuff and we just absorb or we perceive the world around us. What we know from neuroscience and from brain scans and such is that perception is a process of active construction based on prior experiences and memories. So when you eat that chocolate, it's not just the experience and the taste, but it's all these memories of chocolates you've had in the past, memories that I've just introduced or things that are triggered by what I said. In fact, like the packaging, how many of you looked at that packaging and maybe thought of another luxury brand? I see lots of heads nodding, yeah. And it's not just a dozen or so associations. What neuroscience will tell us is that at any second, we're bombarded with like potentially 4 billion points of stimulus, and the brain can process about 2,000 of those in a second. And that's what's called a neural map. And so we can think of that perception as your neural map of reality. And the best metaphor for this is those concept models we draw, where we draw bubbles and lines and connect those. That's essentially what happens inside of our brains to create the simulation of reality. And it's not that our brain can pick apart bits and pieces, but it consumes the whole of it. So let me give you a very simple example of that. Can everyone read this? It says the cat, right? But you'll notice the H and the A are the identical letter forms. Why is it that we're able to resolve this? Well, our brains will look at all that input and say, aha, I see the pattern. Our brain looks at things as a whole. So that's kind of some opening themes or opening ideas I wanted to get out. So obviously I'm not talking about chocolate. Let's replace chocolate with content. And I think you'll see where this is going. Why I proposed this presentation in the first place was there's a phrase that's used a lot. And by the people who usually say it, the speakers who talk about content strategy, they don't mean how it's often interpreted or heard by other people. But it's this phrase, it's all about content. And that's true to the extent that everything starts with content or content is the core, but it doesn't end with content. It's not all about content. In fact, in terms of experience, it's not all about content. I was sitting in a conference last summer and someone was talking and they made the statement, it's all about content. And of course, everyone started tweeting that. That was the thing that was being retweeted. And I was like, oh, geez. So I tweeted back to that. I said, content doesn't exist independent of some presentation form. Even type choice and delivery mode affects perception of written content. The typeface that you set a document will affect our perception of those words. It will affect the comprehension of those words. It will affect so many things. And that's just type, right? That's just typography. And then I wrote this, which I didn't expect anyone to understand. In language, I said content plus presentation plus other forms of content equal perception and meaning. And what I meant by that was, what I had in my head was a model like this. So think of kind of a yin-yang symbol, and you have content at the center, and then you have presentation. So content is the what, the presentation is the how it's presented to you. And then outside of that, you have external context. So that is, where is the context that this is taking place? Who, where, when, and why? And then a lot of times when we think of context, we think of those very external things, but there's also the internal context. So as you're sampling this chocolate, it may be that you're sick to your stomach, or you've had a bad experience with chocolate in the past, or you're in a bad mood today, or a great mood. All these things internally are going to affect your perception of the content itself. And so that's kind of the basis or where I want to start from. And we know this, and we see this in everyday life. If you've watched or you know about the TV show The Voice, what is the point of tension? What is the drama in that show? It's a show kind of like American Idol, but instead of being able to see the performers, your back is to the performers, so you can just hear their voice. And the dramatic part about that is when they all rotate the chairs around, they get to see the person they've been hearing. And so what they're doing is they're removing one of the senses, the sense of sight, and you're left to rely on the voice and maybe audience reactions to form your perceptions. So that's the drama of this show. There have been many studies with wine labels and wine bottles. Some of the ones that have been most fascinating to me are ones that actually show that when you put a more expensive label on the exact same bottle of wine, it's not that we perceive it as being better, but by perceiving, we actually believe it to be better. On our brain scans, we'll show that people believe the wine actually tasted better, and it did from a scientific perspective. This is Joshua Bell, very famous violinist. People will pay hundreds of dollars to go see him perform. There was an experiment done a few years ago where he went on a subway corner wearing a cap and playing on his $3.5 million Stradivarius, collecting change, and hundreds of people walked by. In fact, I think one or two stopped and thought, wow, he sounds like a pretty talented guy. But you've taken this performer, the content, and you've taken him now out of the context and the big auditorium, the stadiums where people pay to see him. Even the legal area, lawyers are starting to pay attention to the typography used and starting to understand typography and how it affects perception. And not just Comic Sans versus Times, but here we've got a typeface that was created for legal documents, and here we've got Times New Roman. A little history, by the way, didn't know this, but Times New Roman was created for the newspaper, and it was designed to facilitate fast reading, which means it's not good for comprehension. It doesn't help people slow down to actually absorb the words they're reading. And you look at these and you're like, wow, what are the differences, right? But there are subtle differences that affect our perception and our understanding of that content. Wired Magazine commented on a research study that was done just a few months ago, and the headline was, "Easily pronounced names may make people more likable." This is a quote from it. "Though it may seem impossible and certainly inadvisable to judge a person by their name, a new study suggests our brains try anyway. The more pronounceable a person's name is, the more likely people are to favor them." And this makes sense from a cognitive perspective. It's this idea called familiarity bias, where you have a bias or preference for things that we're familiar to or exposed to. Share one more personal example. Big Star Wars fan. Do we have any Star Wars fans out there? So here's the exact same product, but what's different? In fact, I took a photo with my phone because I saw this. And I was just like, I love this product. I want to buy this product for my kid, the one on the left. The one on the right, that's all the new stuff, right? But it's the exact same toy. It's just the packaging. That packaging brought me back to my youth and when I was a boy, and that was, the toy I wanted at Christmas. So again, packaging there affecting my perceptions. And marketers know this. In fact, there's a branch of marketing right now, it's very popular, called nostalgic marketing, or nostalgia, where they're tapping into this desire for things as they were. So let's go back and have a little more scientific view of the brain, go a little bit deeper, a little more technical. I had that model. We talked about the stimulus or the world out there. That is reality. But we don't all see the same reality. And that's because what we experience is filtered through our senses. And I think traditional belief has been that there are five senses, but more recently, over the years, over the decades, we've discovered there are other senses we have, and they don't work in isolation. They all work in concert together to create our simulation or our perception of reality, which is organized in our brain. And there's actually steps that happen. There's iconic memory, things that happen in milliseconds before it enters our consciousness. And there's short-term memory, where we make all the decisions and we hold information for a time. And then there's long-term memory, which is those bits and pieces that we have stored away, indexed maybe, that we pull back into our short-term memory to make decisions. Let me simplify this for the purpose of the next 30 minutes. You have reality, which is the world out there, and you have the world you perceive, which is a simulation. And this is how I'm going to divide up the next 30 minutes. I'm going to spend some time talking about the world out there, and that'll be the easiest stuff to get some practical use out of. And then I'm going to shift gears and talk about the world you perceive and some interesting studies on there. So let's zoom out, take a macro view, and talk about the world out there. And to do this, I actually want to go back to the year 2006, to Vancouver, to the very first IA summit that I attended back then. And I had submitted a presentation to the IA summit. It got rejected, but they said, would you like to present it as a poster instead? And I was like, yeah, okay. And so I created this poster, and this was my first IA summit back in 2006, and I was talking about this poster that I'll show you in a minute. By the way, what did I just do there with that sound? I was appealing to multiple senses, right? So it's sensory appeal or multi-sensory appeal. Again, there's lots of studies behind that. But this was the poster, and I created this poster, this model, to answer some questions that I was wrestling with. And these were the questions. There was a big debate. Is good experience simply about task accomplishment? Like, should everything we do be invisible? Look at Craigslist, look at Google, they're just fine, right? Isn't that a great experience? So that was one conversation. There was another conversation talking about the experience economy and holding up things like Chuck E. Cheese and talking about how you're not really paying for the pizza, you're paying for the experience. And in that sense, experience was a very theatrical thing. That was their definition. And then you had experiences like people talk about the product and the service and the experience of it. So Starbucks is an experience. Build-A-Bear. How many of you are familiar with Build-A-Bear Workshop? You basically pay more to go in and build your own bear, right? Kids love this because it's self-expression. They're getting to personalize their bear, pick out which one, how much stuffing they put in it, pick their clothes and do all this stuff. And that caused me to ask, well, what are we really buying here? It's not the bear, but it's something I created. It's almost like a work of art in a way, or some self-expression. And then there's the whole neuromarketing stuff, which was getting a lot of buzz in 2006, and the whole idea that we really aren't in control of our minds and our beliefs. And there were some studies done with Coke and Pepsi, and they would do a brain scan when there was a blind taste test, and they would show people the brand, and the brain would actually rewire and change, and you would actually perceive that drink differently after you saw the brand. Some pretty scary stuff. There was an article that had been posted as well by a fairly prominent UX person, and he came down very hard on this new ad talking about Folgers, the new packaging. He's like, that's not part of the experience. In fact, he stated packaging was not part of the user experience, which I found odd when you think about things like chocolate, right, that we've been talking about. So you had all these phrases going around, user experience, the experience economy, designing for experiences, brand experiences, experience design strategy, customer experience management, experiential marketing. We could probably add onto this. And my question was, they've all got a grain of truth in them. No one's exactly wrong, but how do we resolve all these? Because they're all presented as if they're conflicting ideas. And so this is the poster I came up with. It's a big 3-foot by 4-foot poster, lots of detail, but I want to walk through just the building of it. And so if you have pen and paper and you can sketch this would be a good time to do that. You might find this useful for seeing how all the pieces fit together. So really, it's three circles. There's a bullseye in the middle and then two rings coming out from that. So the bullseye is the direct experience, whether it's a service or a product or what have you. It's that direct interaction, the thing that happens in the middle. And then you have the presentation layer, which is how it's presented to you, how it's packaged, like the packaging, how I introduced the chocolate. And then you have the communications layer, how you became aware of it. So direct, indirect, and then how you became aware. And there's more details. I put some words in here. So if you want to look at the slides afterwards, you can dive a little bit deeper. Another way to put it is the core interaction, the presentation layer, and the communications layer that made you aware of it. So that's the first piece, is having those three rings labeled. The next piece is, think of the upper half and the bottom half as being company space and personal space. So company space is everything that clearly the company is doing and telling and building and constructing. The personal space is my personal construct or my social network or my friends, people not affiliated with the company. And this line, if you want to make it a little bit blurry or wavy, that's fine, because in this age of social media, it's hard to tell sometimes who's a shill for the company and who's not. Although I think when we find out someone's been paid for something, that line still very much exists for us. So the company space, the personal space, bottom half of this. And then finally, there are kind of two extremes to this. Originally, I called it like rational and emotional, and at the IA Summit, someone corrected me and said, you really should call it transactional and engaging. I was like, okay, I don't know what I'm talking about, so that sounds good. You have transactional engaging, and what I mean by that is there are gonna be things that are more direct and appealing to reason, and things that are more emotional and creating a feeling in us. So the rational side, what does this do? How much does it cost? What are the features? The emotional, how does this make me feel? Does this provide meaning or pleasure? Those types of things. And so you put it all together and you end up with a model like this. And what I love about this is suddenly everything that a company does, aside from finance and operational stuff, everything design-wise, engineering-wise, marketing-wise, advertising, PR, fits in this model. And you see how it all relates together. And I would say companies that are really, really good at orchestrating this create phenomenal experiences because they're shaping not only great products, but our perceptions of those products. Apple would be a perfect example of this, a company who's mastered all of these areas and has them working together well. So here's the poster. Now, there was a bit of insight that I think I stumbled onto or lucked into that I wasn't thinking about nearly to the degree I am now, and that is when you zoom into the center of the ring, the core experience, I put down here, you have the thing itself, whatever that is, and then I put perceptions of the thing. So again, the reality of the thing, the simulation of the thing. My language has changed, but at that time, I knew that someone might like this piece of chocolate and someone else may hate it. So there is a perception piece that plays into everything. So with that, I'd like to turn the corner and let's go from the world out there, which is this macro view of how everything fits together. And now let's zoom in to the world that we perceive, or the world you perceive. And as I go through this, I want you to think about associations. With every example I'm going to show, I want you to think about associations. I'm not going to trick you with anything here. There's no trick test or anything, but I'm putting all these together, starting with simpler ideas and building up to more complex for the purpose of focusing on the associations, that neural map, those neural networks, those connections that we're making, and understanding why or how our brain works. So we'll start off with something really simple. What is this that we're looking at? A, yeah, tells you there's no trick questions, all right? So this is the letter A, and the question I would ask is, how do you know that this is the letter A? And it seems like a simple, obvious thing, but this is actually a big problem for artificial intelligence and getting computer systems to recognize an object as an A. If you can say, a 16-point Helvetica A is an A, then it'll recognize that Helvetica, but if you change the font a bit, the computer's like, I don't know what that is, because it's not a pattern match to what I've seen. And you see this in young kids learning to write. When kids have learned block letters and you maybe introduce cursive, they're like, I don't know what this is. They haven't made that connection yet, but over time, kind of the boundary object or our definition of what an A is expands so that we can look at all these and say, yep, these are all A's, right? We know we've seen the common attributes, we've seen these patterns. So our brain is doing some pattern matching. Simple enough, right? Make sense? This is a fun project that a guy pulled together. He took these famous logos and he abstracted them simply to circles and colors. That's all it is. So let's play a quick pattern matching game. What brand is this? Come on, this is the easy one. Come on. Subway. Yeah, this is Subway. All right, how about this one? Dunkin' Donuts. How about this one? American Airlines. This one, the colors are a bit off, but FedEx. Yeah. All right, so how did you know that? All right, you were making associations based on circles, the number of circles, and colors, right? That was it. But even at that, you were able to do some pattern matching between, I've recognized this, I've seen it before, and I recognize this, I can make sense of it. Now the next example I will say is rated PG-13 for nudity in a sexual situation. So if you want to turn your eyes, that's fine. I just wanted to give you a heads up. This is an optical illusion that someone created, and I would be willing to bet most of you see two lovers, a guy behind the gal. Here's the interesting thing though. If you show this picture to young children, you know what they see? Dolphins. They see dolphins. And it's because they're used to seeing dolphins all the time. That's their mental image. That's the thing they're mapping to. Some adults never see the dolphins, so I put So if you didn't see the dolphins, I colored them in here for you. All right. Okay, so continuing with this theme of how our brain tries to match things together, let's look at things that are occasionally interesting combinations. Okay, why is this funny? It's funny because there's a headline for an article and there's a picture and we see it and our brains again take everything and input it at once and try to resolve it. This is why if you say the wrong word or maybe the color's off on your slides, all these things, it's all feeding into perceptions and the perceptions that people have. And these are funny when you get weird juxtapositions. In fact, that's the scientific word for it, juxtaposition, when you have those things. I threw in a few more because they were kind of funny. Man jumps off ferry. There's one. When a dream. There's one. Yeah. Okay. By the way, I got these from a humor site, and I'm hoping there's no one offended by this next one. But this next one isn't juxtaposition, but when you look at it, I think something's going to happen. I'll just leave it up here for a second. All right, is anyone constructing a story? Yeah. Now, the reason you would construct a story is because you have prior experiences and memories that you're drawing on. You see some stuff that causes tension that you don't know the answer to, and you're making some inferences, some judgments, maybe right or maybe completely wrong, and you're layering a story to explain some of the things that are going on in this image. Again, that's bringing those experiences to resolve what you see here. Here's another one. Have you remember Susan Boyle on the UK version of American Idol? Her story is interesting because when she came out, and you have this cat lady, and you have her dressed in the dress she was wearing and all that, what did people expect? They didn't expect anything, right? They expected another bad performer. And then she started singing, and her voice was just angelic, right? And that caught everyone off guard because the story that they had overlaid and projected onto her just from those few seconds of her walking out was suddenly challenged, right? And our brains are attracted to points of contrast or things that surprise us. Those are the things that stand out. In fact, I threw in contrast here because usually we think of contrast being perceptual contrast, like, red standing out against green. But contrast in a cognitive sense also means cognitive contrast, ideas that stand out against each other. And here was a perfect example of that, where our expectations weren't in line with the reality of what happened next. All right, let's shift to language a bit. This is a study that's been done where they'll put people in front of a video, they'll watch a car crash and a wreck, and after the fact, they'll ask people, how fast was the car going when it hit the other car? And people will write down a number. They'll ask a separate group of people, how fast was the car going when it smashed into the other car? You want to guess which group generally writes a much higher number? The second one. This is something that magicians exploit all the time. It's called the fallacy of memory. Like, our memories, again, aren't like a filed away thing that we pull forward. Our memories are constructed in the moment. If a magician says something and then changes the language a bit later on, they're changing our perceptions, and we're forgetting what they really said earlier on. And in this study, and there have been numerous studies like this, just the changing of the phrasing, suddenly we remember it as being faster than maybe it was by changing the word from hit to smashed into. And this is an example of priming. Priming, anchoring sometimes in this picture, but we're priming people with our language. Survey questions. This was a survey that was done, and they would ask these two questions in this series, and they would say, how happy are you? And most people would say, oh, pretty happy, or you know, whatever. And then they would say, how often are you dating? And people would answer that question. And they found very little correlation between these two questions. Anyone guess what they did next? They switched the questions. And so they would ask people, well, how often are you dating? And people would answer a number, and they would say, yeah, how happy are you? And what they found was a significantly higher correlation. When you prime people with how often do you date first, and people answer, oh, not very much, then the answer to the very next question was, I must not be very happy because I'm not dating very often. None of this is new, by the way. This is communications 101. This is advertising 101. In the 60s, there was a paper written that talked about how we perceive of things, and one of the ideas in there was this idea of coded iconic messages. So in this ad for this packaged spaghetti, they talk about the coded iconic messages. And those are things like using the colors of Italy, so the green, the red, those colors, the white, putting things in a basket suggests freshness. Having the tomatoes there suggests that this is fresh, this is good. This is coded iconic messages. They're not overt, they're not direct, but they're in there suggesting to you that, oh yeah, this is a fresh Italian pasta, you should buy it. We also have other interesting things. I'm gonna show you a version of this image next, and I want you to see if you can spot the differences. Okay, and if you've ever heard Bill Scott talk, he talks about this in his discussions. This is the first image. Here it is again. Raise your hand if you spotted the difference there. Okay, a few of you, all right. Let me go back. So there is the original. I'm gonna do it again. Any more of you spotted that time? All right, here's what's happening. Now let me do without the pause. Let me just do them back to back. So here's the image, there it is. Do you see it? Okay, what we're doing is when there's that pause, when there's that break, our brain like basically resets, and then the next image is something totally new. But when they're back to back, we can see the contrast. In this case, the contrast happens over time. We can spot the change easily. In Bill Scott's presentations, when he's talking about rich applications, he's talking about if we have a pause or a reload that causes a flicker like this, people might not see what's happening. Very critical to designing rich interactions. All right, moving on. How many of you have seen these photos like that? These look like they're toy cars, right? Like they're Hot Wheels or Matchbox. Same here, this looks like a model that someone built. And I've enjoyed looking at these and musing on that. And the reason they look like miniatures is because our brains, biologically, are tuned to put things out of focus that are very close to us. It's talking about depth of field. And the closer an object is, the more narrow your range of focus becomes. Our brains have spent a lifetime, or at least youth, for the farsighted, associating a tight depth of field with closeness. So now when you take something that's obviously like from the top of a building or something like that, and you add that stuff that we normally in reality only see when it's up close, it starts to mess with our mental perceptions. And we think, this looks like the only way I could see this, the only way my brain can resolve this, is if it was, you know, a miniature version. Make sense? All right. Now we're gonna get into some of the really freaky stuff. This one's so freaky, I'm just gonna have to read the text so I don't butcher anything. You're not gonna believe me otherwise. This is a study that explored literal and metaphorical mix-ups and confusions and how things that have nothing to do with each other can get mixed up. So I'll just read this. Volunteers would meet one of the experimenters, believing that they would be starting the experiment shortly. In reality, the experiment began when the experimenter, seemingly struggling with an armful of folders, asked the volunteer to briefly hold their coffee. As the key experimental manipulation, the coffee was either hot or iced, completely unrelated. Subjects then read a description of some individual. Students who had recently been cradling the warm beverage were far likelier to judge the fictitious character as warm and friendly than were those who held the iced coffee. And now a lot of you are thinking, whoa, this doesn't make sense. But if you think about the theme I'm trying to reinforce throughout this, which is our brain has all of these bits floating around in here, and we're trying to resolve them and make sense of these things, then you can understand holding that warm beverage. You know, we think we have this concept of warm floating in our head now. Now we're judging someone, and whether it's unrelated or not, we have that concept of warm as an idea, and we have this person, and we're more likely, at least according to the study, to attribute that to that person. The next one, I was just going to talk about it, assuming a lot of people have been exposed to it, and I started asking people, and a lot of people haven't yet. So I'll let you be subjects in this next experiment, okay? The instructions are pretty simple. You're going to watch a video, and some people are going to be passing a basketball, and your job is to count how many times the players wearing white pass the basketball, okay? So again, the instructions are count how many times the players wearing white pass the basketball, and I'll quiz you at the end, see if you got the right number. Keeping count? Okay, how many passes did you count? All right, the correct answer was 15. There were 15 pounces. Now, the real question, did you see the gorilla? All right, so the fascinating thing is when they've done this study, yeah, those of you who didn't, watch, there's the gorilla. There's a correlation between those who accurately count how many times the ball gets passed and those who didn't spot the gorilla. So if you're really focused and counting, chances are you didn't spot the gorilla, and this is what this study has shown. And it went on to a book. They've done other similar studies. What I found even more fascinating is they've repeated the study many times and done actual eye tracking to see if it's that your eye just doesn't see the gorilla. And the fascinating thing was your eye actually lands on the gorilla several times. So it's not a perception issue, but it's that cognition issue, that simulation I'm talking about. And so they call this inattentional blindness. And the idea that stems from this is that visual perception is more than photons entering your eyes and activating your brain, the other things we see. To truly see, you must pay attention. All right? So we see what we're looking for. It doesn't mean it's in front of our eyes. I told you I've started off with the easy stuff, and I'm building up to the whoa stuff. All right? Here was my aha moment from all this. When I was stepping back, and this was just a few months ago, and this may sound trivial to some of you guys, you may share the enthusiasm I did, but I was looking at all this stuff, and even in my book, I wrote about how we react affectively to something, how we react cognitively to things. I did have a section where I talked about how we make associations, but I started laying these things out. By the way, the context was an InfoViz workshop I was doing, and I started laying these out, and on one end, you have things like aesthetic associations, and those would be things like shapes, colors, movement. In nature, if something's round versus sharp, it suggests it's going to be, you know, nice and friendly versus it's going to cut us. This cuts across language even. This is something called the Bubba-Kiki effect. One of these is named Bubba, one of these is named Kiki, and 99% of the people, 99.9% of the people usually name one of these as Kiki and one of these as Bubba. Completely made up words, completely made up shapes. Anyone want to guess which one is Kiki? One left, anyone want to guess which one's Bubba? Yeah, it goes to like the shape of the mouth and the shape, and this also ties into studies on synesthesia, which is where we mix up senses. Then you have perceived affordances. So if I show you two shapes, you know, like this in this case, which one of these is closer? Yeah, the one on the right. Why? Because it overlaps. It's tapping into our perceived affordances. So then you have things like semiotics, iconography. So we see symbols and they represent ideas. Then you have conceptual metaphors. I threw in the iceberg because I think we've all sat through a presentation where the iceberg model was used to explain an idea. And then you have, on this other end, narratives and stories. And there's a lot of talk now around why narratives and stories are so powerful. And I started looking at these. I'm like, you know what? These are all the exact same thing. These all share something in common, and that is this associative function of the brain, or pattern matching. You're starting off with very small things, which is, oh, this is sharp in nature and would cut me, therefore this is sharp in this other context, to these narratives, which are really big constructions. That's why narratives are so powerful, because with just a few words, you can invoke something that has a whole bunch preloaded into it, and you can bring that into someone's consciousness. All right, so at this point, with a few minutes left, you're thinking, okay, this is really interesting. Is there any practical application for all this stuff? I would say yes. One, I would say things like Twitter and things like Quora have afforded wonderful opportunities to test out how people perceive and respond to stuff. Let me give you an example with Quora, which is the question and answer site. I've started noticing some patterns and kind of hacking my own answers or hacking people's perceptions. And so this is a lot of the answers you'll see at the bottom of a question on Quora. They're very short, sometimes single sentence, sometimes a few multi-sentence, but paragraph answers. And those tend to sift to the bottom. Then you'll see someone who wrote a very verbose answer, not a really long one, but maybe four or five paragraphs. And those will sometimes float in the middle. And then what I've been doing, hacking with people's perceptions, the content's still there, so I'm not making a comment on my content, but I'll write these longer things, but I'll break them into bullets. They're easily scanned. And what I've found is that those types of answers, not just my own, but others, are the ones that tend to shoot up on Quora and get the most votes. Well, why would this be? Well, if you think about perceptions, short answer means poor quality, right? Verbose answer means too much effort for me to read, and they're too long-winded to structure their ideas. But hey, a lengthy, digestible answer that's broken into bullets, ah, just right. It's kind of like Goldilocks, right? Finding just the right thing. Then there are exceptions. People will throw in images, and that shoots all the way to the top, right? Or the person who writes a book, that shoots to the top, because we assume if they've written a book on this, they're probably an authority, right? They have some knowledge. You might remember this. When Steve Jobs announced the iPad, he did something very intentional. He had a couch or had a chair set up, and he sat and reclined and put the iPad there. This is an example of positive mimicry. He was modeling or showing us the intended use of the iPad. It was introducing this new concept, the third computer, and he wanted to show people this passive consumption of content, how it'd be used. Let's say you write a really long email to me, and I send you back a very short, terse, three-word response. Sounds great, right? Or go with it. You might think, dude, I put a lot of time into that, right? You might be offended. What if it has this attached to it? All right, suddenly that changes your perception, sent from my iPhone. When I'm talking, I often talk about my family and my kids, but I'm very careful to say my kids or my boys. I'm very careful not to say four boys. I have four boys, because the moment I say four boys, and you see you're happening right now, you're like, holy crap, he's got four boys. And you've completely forgotten whatever it is I have to say. So I'm very conscious about my language because I know what's going to happen in your brain, what you're going to start thinking about. Also with my boys, I'm proud to say I have boys who love their vegetables, and you know, a lot of people make jokes about eating your veggies and things, and those don't work on my kids because they love their veggies. And at a very young age, I've always tried to frame veggies as a great thing and something all people love. And even when we go to a salad bar and they have like cucumber slices, I call them cucumber chips. Now, what am I doing? Yeah, you know what I'm doing, right? I'm hacking with their perceptions. So they're chips, right? They're cucumber chips. And the kids love chips. And they go, oh, okay, cucumber chips. They love their cucumbers. This is a concept model I presented at the IA Summit a few years ago called the Fundamentals of Experience Design. Beyond the content itself and the idea, which is, again, the core, when I chose to visually represent this, I spent hours looking for the right illustration, and I wanted something that would look like something you would see in a science textbook, for example, like a diagram, a technical illustration. I wanted that academic association. I'm not from the world of academia, right? I'm not going to make that claim, but in the presentation, in the packaging of my content, I was making those intentional aesthetic associations, all right? Here's another example. This was actually one where someone wasn't thinking about perceptions. I had a meeting last week. Me and a friend logged on to have our 8 o'clock meeting, and we dialed into Skype, and the guy says, our meeting's just ending. And both of us were like, what? You know, yep, the meeting started an hour ago, 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we're like, wait a second, we thought it was 8 a.m. Central Standard Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And sure enough, I looked at my calendar and I had it as 8 to 9, not 7 to 9. I'm in Central Time, by the way, if I left that out. And then I went back to the original email, and this was the header. It says, we are on for 8 a.m., 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time tomorrow. Now, wait a second. We are on for 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Growing up in the Central Station all my life, whenever you hear advertisements for a TV show, it's always like 8 a.m., 9 p.m. EST, right? That's how they always pitch it. That's what I'm used to, and very rarely do people say the duration. And so it was that one word, too, that when I read, and my friend, I'm glad that it wasn't me alone in it, we both read it as it would start at 8 a.m. March Central Standard Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Does that make sense? The error we made? Let me show you one more example, and I'll wrap things up. When I'm presenting new ideas, and they may not be novel or something, but they may be unfamiliar to people, recognizing that they may not have that story or that mental construct in their head, oftentimes, if it's an idea I want to kind of push through, or push through enough that I can get good constructive feedback, I will anchor it with something they are familiar with. We had this idea, I was labeling the activity stream, pitching it to a client, and I said, it's really not all that new. It's kind of like instant messaging or newsfeed. So now I had these perceptual anchors, and they were able to then see how my idea was different from that. This happens in the movie industry all the time, right, where people have the five-word pitch. You know, it's going to be like, you know, this movie, Die Hard with, you know, girls or something, you know, whatever it is, right? And there's an anchor there. So 2 points so far. The world out there doesn't equal the world we perceive. And then 2, attention and awareness are hackable. And sometimes we hack it without intending to, like the example of the person who sent out the invite. Now, if you're still thinking, okay, this sounds a bit esoteric, those examples sounded interesting, but I don't know how this is going to help me in my work. I just want to point out a few other professions where they actively think about this, and it's part of their currency and what they do every day. Obviously, magicians do this every day. This is a quote from Teller from an article a couple months ago. And he said, the core of every trick is a cold cognitive experiment and perception. And if you start looking into the world of magic, yeah, there's some sleight of hand stuff there, but a lot of what they do is hacking with our perceptual senses and our cognitive senses. They're hacking with attention and awareness. They're hacking our brains to create these illusions. Film. Film has a long history of, it's not just what's the subject being filmed, but how it's filmed, how it's edited, what they choose to crop into will shape our perceptions. So in this case, this opening for the Road to Perdition, they have the guy is writing from the right to the left. Well, in Western society, we're used to everything moving from left to right. This creates a sense of tension and tells you something about the character before the movie's even started, before you've even met him. They're hacking our perceptions. Disney, if you've been to Disney World, you know when you walk in, that Main Street looks really long and the castle, Cinderella's castle, looks just huge and majestic. Well, they're using something called forced perception to make things look bigger than they really are. And if you were actually to climb up on top of that castle, you'd find that the door wouldn't even reach your waist, right? But it looks grand and creates an impression. Same with their mountains. You know, these are actually really short pine trees that they plant at the top, the little short 3 and 4 and 5 foot things, but it looks like a big tall pine tree from where you're at. Even in the hotel, in the hospitality industry, why do we have this box kind of boxing up the stuff in our bathroom? Well, it goes back to Gestalt psychology, and things that are enclosed actually seem simpler and easier. Final one from photography. Photographers do all sorts of really subtle tricks to drive our eye to focus on something. So here's a case where I just took a flat photo, didn't do anything to it. Here's the after version, and in the previous version, it's hard to see on the screen, but it was easy to have your eye drawn here or to the buckle or other things because they were also points of contrast. But in the after version, I applied a blur around it, and your eye is driven to the center, to the boxes, which is where I wanted to direct you. That's hacking perceptions. So you have all these professions that already do it, education, architecture, photography, magicians. My question is, what about UX? Are we hacking this perceptions? Are we using this? Is it added to our tool set? So I'm going to leave you with 2 questions. 1, what are you doing to intentionally shape perceptions in your work? If there's something you want to pursue more or know a little bit more, I pulled together 9 kind of takeaways. If I had to boil it down to 8 bullets or 9 bullets, this is what I wrote. I'll just comment on 1 because I wanted to end on something really funny. One of the ideas I write down here is that you need to explore the space between the lines. Consider all possible associations, intended or unintended. And let me give you an example of a company or an organization that spent a lot of money on a rebrand, and it wasn't until it was out in the public that they saw an association they hadn't thought of. This is the Office of Government Commerce in the UK. And this was the redesigned logo that they came up with, and very clean, very modern, and all that. And it wasn't until it was out in the public and unprinted and stuff that people actually saw it turned on its side. If you didn't see it. That they saw what other people were perceiving. They had never seen what was just going horizontal. So I want to close with this question. What is your perception strategy? All these slides will be online tomorrow morning, and in the bottom of every slide is a link to the research or the paper's reference. So thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the 2012 IA Summit. The IA Summit podcasts are sponsored by the UIE Virtual Seminar Program with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. For free access to a virtual seminar, visit uie.com/IAS12. And you can find the rest of the IA Summit podcasts at library.iasummit.org.